The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
We invented college demonstrations. And by we, I mean baby boomers. I'm one of them. I was at Kent State way back in the 70s. I missed the famous one there on May 4th, 1970, when four kids were killed. But I was there for the one-year anniversary of that, and there were plenty of demonstrations going on that day then, back then, and then there were others during the time that I was there. Now, maybe you've noticed there's some of that going on right now on campuses around the country. For some reasons, it's mostly Ivy League campuses. There's a lot of anti-Israel and anti-Semitism going around. It makes for great TV, the big crowds and everything. So it's getting a ton of coverage on all the news channels. And don't think that the kiddies don't see that. Here's what would happen when there would be a major demonstration on a campus. And this was not only at Kent State. I had friends at colleges all over the country who told me the same thing happened on their campus. There's a cause that gets people fired up, and it's a small amount of people who actually are really fired up, and they're fired up enough about it to want to go down to the common grounds on campus somewhere and make a scene or take over a building or something like that. But we're talking about college kids here. And when there was a demonstration, it was party time. You'd get a call from somebody who happened to be in the area where the demonstrations were starting to take place and crowds were beginning to gather, and they'd say, "Hey, come on down. It's crazy down here." And you would go as a spectator with the idea that you might have some fun. You might even meet some chicks. You might end up at a party somewhere. That's not to say that there weren't plenty of serious people there demonstrating against the Vietnam War at that time, and that there aren't serious people now demonstrating in favor of Palestine or for Israel, but everybody needs to keep in mind that the size of the crowd should be taken with a grain of salt. Just because a lot of people are there doesn't necessarily mean that the cause caused them to show up. Think about it. You're a 20-year-old kid sitting in your dorm room. Somebody comes by and tells you, "Hey, it's crazy out there. The demonstrations and the demonstrators and the cops are going at it." Are you staying in the dorm? Or are you headed to where the action is? I know where I was headed if I was 20. The anti-Israel movement on college campuses seems to be really growing, and it's spreading across the country and all over the country, but it's probably not that big a deal to most kids on most campuses. I'm just saying. When we come back, the weather is warming up. That means you're likely to see more tents on the city streets of Pittsburgh, and the Supreme Court may have something to say soon about how many tents you'll be seeing in Pittsburgh or anywhere else around the country. And in our second half hour, one more reason to kick the United Nations out of the United States and for the United States to get out of the United Nations. Stick around. Well, with the weather warming up, there's a really good chance that you're about to see more tents, needles, and poop, maybe, on the streets in the city here. It's gotten much worse the last couple of years, but we're not on the same league as the cities on the West Coast. Victoria Taft writes a feature called West Coast Mess Coast at PJ Media. She's also the host of the Adult in the Room podcast and a frequent guest on this radio show, and she joins us now. Victoria, good to see talk to you again. We haven't talked to you for a while. How are you?
Well, it's great to be in Stagger World, and yes, we haven't spoken, but it's time. We can catch up now.
Yes, very good. So Now, might Pittsburgh and every other city get some help on this from the Supreme Court?
Possibly. It sounds promising. Yeah, they're re-looking at Martin v. Boise, Idaho. That was the decision in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on the West Coast, West Coast, and other states that said that you have to have a bed for somebody before you can kick them off public square, you know, and their camping apparatus and all that stuff. And what that did was created an odd mathematical equation and a decision by certain cities in the Ninth Circuit. And that decision was, well, I mean, we could ask everybody who's on the street and if they need shelter, and we routinely do that, but we're not going to keep track of them and who said no and who said yes. Therefore, we should have bedding commensurate with all of the homeless people on the street, and we can't afford it. And so here we are, we can't really tell them to get off the street. So that has been the Hobson's choice that has been enjoyed, if you will, by these cities on the West Coast, West Coast, the Ninth Circuit. And that's where we are now. And that is why you see such an incredible proliferation of hot and cold running homeless people on the streets of these cities. And to add an overlay of absolute horribleness is the fact that a lot of these cities, the states at the state level, said, hey, you know, we're just going to decriminalize hard drug use.
Yeah, what could
which
go
then
wrong
brought
there?
Another. Yeah. Oh, yeah. What could go wrong? That brought a bunch of others. And there are such things as homeless tourists. I mean, these are people who drive in with their RVs or people who bus in from across the country. I've met a few of them, and they come over here because the weather's nicer, the winters aren't as harsh, and they got free stuff here. They pay people to be homeless.
What kind of free stuff do they get? If I show up next winter in California for a, you know, I just decide I'd get an RV, an old RV, and park it there, mm-hmm. what kind of free stuff am I going to get?
You won't get kicked out.
No.
You might get a free housing voucher. You're not required to get any sort of drug testing or what have you in order to get any additional monies from the state. The state of California, for example, has spent literally billions upon billions of dollars to, quote unquote, solve the homeless crisis. And they've purchased, or rather, purchased them. But they decide, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to build homeless some housing. And, of course, those are outrageously expensive because, as the state of California found out, to build in the state of California, there are all kinds of user fees, regulations, and additional expenses to spend or to build these homes.
In a state run by Democrats, there are a lot of regulations and things preventing business from happening.
Finally, Kevin Kiley, who is Gavin Newsom's former assemblyman, and he went on to become a U.S. congressman, thank God, to be in the U.S. Congress. He before he left, he and another lawmaker got a bill passed whereby they would go through and audit the housing or the spending on homeless services. The $24 billion that they've spent so far on homelessness. And you're not going to believe this, but people weren't keeping track of where the money was going.
No kidding.
No, I know. That's a big shocker, I'm sure.
Well, wait, though. Here's the thing, though, Victoria. you mentioned that it created a kind of a confusing situation and a conundrum of some sort that you want the homeless off the street, but you can't kick them off, and because it's your, when I say your, the government's responsibility to find some place for them to sleep, if not have shelter.
Right. Has that ever happened in U.S. history?
Well, that's a nice concept. Maybe a nice thought. It makes you a nice person if you're in government and you think that you should take other people's money and pay for bums on the street to get off. But that's another issue. Did they come to the idea that it's unconstitutional for the city to say, you're pooping on the street, get out? That's now unconstitutional.
Because to banish somebody is cruel and unusual punishment, they argue, under the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
That's kind of a stretch.
It's an incredible stretch. And the justices in yesterday's hearing were, the oral arguments, were having a kind of a tough time with it. The only one who was just an unmitigated fangirl of doing something about the homeless. And of course, we're all fangirls about that, fanboys and fangirls about that. But the thing is that when you articulate it, like, for example, Sonia Sotomayor did, you just really wonder about what she thinks the place of government is. Here's what she said. She said that where do we put the homeless if every city, every village, every town lacks compassion and decides to pass an identical law to the Grants Pass law, which is what they were litigating yesterday. How long have you been, you know, where are they supposed to sleep? Are they supposed to kill themselves not sleeping?
But here, Victoria, here's what I don't get. And here's the quote. Where do we put the homeless if every city, every village, every town lacks compassion and passes a law identical to this? How does she end up on the Supreme Court with that lack of knowledge of what the what the federal government's responsibility or power is, that because you feel bad for something or because you have sympathy for somebody and you happen to work in government, that makes it constitutional, that it's unfair.
Right. It's a new right.
It makes them unhappy. That has nothing to do with it. It's sick. But the thing is, she made it to the Supreme Court. How did she get to even become a judge, you know, a magistrate somewhere?
Well, Obama put her in.
Yeah, I know that. But she had to get somewhere to get to the point to get, you know, in position to be nominated.
The statement she made about this issue yesterday, and you can say, okay, she's very concerned, as are we all. But it's as dumb as when Ketanji Brown Jackson said, but wait a minute, you're suggesting that the government can be told, you know, to be reduced in its ability to control speech.
Yeah.
How could the government be constrained from controlling speech? If we pass this or we do what you want to do, the government could be constrained. How do you square that? Well, hello, that's what the First Amendment is supposed to do. But anyway, it's as dumb as that.
Yeah, well, here's the way I look at these kinds of things. So you have, imagine if it worked this way. You live in, pick a city, Portland, San Francisco, one of these places where the homeless are everywhere. And they're in your neighborhood. And someone knocks on your door and they're showing credentials that they're from the government. And they say, hello, we're here to collect $50 from you. Well, what for? Well, we have some homeless people out on the street and we're raising some money. We're going to get them a nice room in a hotel. And we've decided that, you know, that we're going to take care of that. And you say, well, I don't care about where they live. I want them out of here. I don't want to give you my $50. And they say, oh, no. It's the law. We voted on it. We took a survey of the people here in the neighborhood, and it came out 82-78 that we're going to do this. So give me $50 or you're going to prison. That's what they're doing to you if they make you pay. Make me pay for some mentally disturbed vagrant on the street to whatever they want to get for him. But if I want to vote for that, I guess that's fine. But it's the government.
Well,
it's just such overstep.
Well, you're right. And the thing is that if you want to help the homeless, nobody is holding you back from doing that.
Right.
You can work for the Union Gospel Mission. You can go and you can help out at the Salvation Army. There are myriad homeless organizations that you could give your time and resources to.
Yeah.
But
the
government's not a charity.
No. And because the majority of the people voted the people on my street, in my little condo neighborhood, the homeowners association got together and said, listen, everybody has to kick in $100. Mrs. Smith's daughter needs an abortion. And so, we need to collect that money from it. Well, no, I don't like abortion. Well, that doesn't matter. We voted. There's 50 people voted and 35 said yes and 15 said no. So give me your money. It doesn't matter that you voted. It's still my right not to. You don't have the right to steal my money from me and give it to somebody else. It's just sick.
Those are taxes, and that's what happens. And they set priorities, and they may not match yours. But I look at the California experience and the whole West Coast, wherein they said, 20 years ago that they had a plan, and it was a 10-year plan to end homelessness. And we're on year 20 of that 10-year plan.
What a shock.
And California has never kept track of the money. And what had happened was they went to San Diego and went to Santa Clara, I think it was. And they went to those counties and said, okay, how have you guys been spending the money? And they couldn't figure it out. Whereupon they said, okay, that means that if these, you know, with naval precision in San Diego and with Silicon Valley precision in Santa Clara, neither of these cities, these counties, knew where the money was going. So you can safely assume, and they did for purposes of this study, all of the 58 counties in California didn't know. They've been hiding the ball, $24 billion.
And
that's on top of the $60 billion he already lost. Oh, $30 billion, excuse me, from the doggone the unemployment program that Gavin Newsom just biffed. And then you've got that on top of the other $60 billion that they're in arrears on in deficit in California. It's a doggone mess.
And if he ran for governor tomorrow against Thomas Jefferson, who came back from the dead, he'd win in a landslide, correct?
Well, honestly, there's another recall for Gavin Newsom thing. And here's the objective, I think, is to get it on the November 24th ballot, or 2024 ballot. Yeah. I don't know if it's going to, it qualified, but I don't know if it's qualified for that election. Anything to drive people to the polls, I guess.
I thought of something else, too. If it's constitutional for the government to remove homeless people and vagrants from the street because you can't do that because they don't have another place to sleep or live, how do they justify sheriff sale, where the government can come and take my house from me,
they can't justify that. The kind of niggling question that occurred in this portion of the conversation yesterday was, okay, well, can a homeless person be a status as a homeless person and be able to sleep at the shelter? Are they still homeless? Can the person couch surf on their friend's sofa? Are they still homeless?
Yeah.
Well, what actually describes being homeless? And they go, well, no permanent house at which they can which they could call their own.
You've written a lot about this, Victoria. We're talking to Victoria Taft of PJ Media. It's my fault, for I should have done this myself. I think about it and then I forget about it. Have you looked into what the vagrancy laws used to be in places like San Francisco and, for that matter, Pittsburgh? It used to be that the cops would come by, and if you were a bum on the street, they either picked you up and dumped you outside of town somewhere, or they put you in a jail for the night, and they told you if you come back tomorrow, we're putting you in jail again. Are there not vagrancy laws still on the books in some of these places?
I believe that they've been defined down under California laws, specifically in California, that and loitering laws. There are... remember, you used to see anti-loitering signs all over the place. That's not operational anymore either. Sure, I suppose somebody on their own private property could say that, but in public squares and stuff like that. I mean, it's been obviated. It's been blown up, imploded, and it's been made meaningless by all of the Occupy movement, the people who camp on the streets, the Antifa people who have taken over the effort in Seattle, for example, to stop people from cleaning out encampments, because their objective, as we talked about before, the left's objective, and especially Antifa's objective, is to keep things in a state of chaos. Mm-hmm. This is a real battle that they have. This is a desired outcome. Stated desired outcome. And so they don't want people getting help. This is serious. I mean, the example, one guy who's out on the street helping homeless guys all the time. I Heart Seattle. Mm-hmm. They go to this guy and he's finally ready to get some help with his addiction. He's out on the street. He lives in a squat, little tent, pop tent, whatever. And he's finally ready. Well, Antifa and the, efforts to stop people from getting help come along and they convince the guy not to go with them. And they have a sort of a verbal battle. The next day, that guy dies of an overdose.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. I have 30 seconds left, Victoria. Can people living back here almost on the opposite coast have any real grasp of how ridiculous the homeless problem is out there without being there?
Well, Imagine going downtown and the sidewalks are full of campers. They've managed to, for example, in Portland, they've managed to scrub that, but then they've been banished to freeway entrances and off ramps. They are in parks. They are along bike trails where people are now afraid to ride their bicycles and children dare not play. They are in places of,
they're like cicadas.
Yeah. Well, they don't come every 17 years, though.
Yeah, that's true.
They're here all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, boy. All right. Well, hey, Victoria, hope we don't go as long between now and the next time we talk, but I always love having you on. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, John.
Okay, that's Victoria Taft. You can check her out at pjmedia.com or the Adults in the Room contact, what do you call them? Podcast. Yeah, I'll be right back. I wish Donald Trump would announce today that if he's elected, he'll pull the U.S. out of the United Nations. I don't know, maybe January 21st, 2025 would be a good time to do it, but that's probably not going to happen. If he's not elected and Joe Biden or whoever replaces him is elected, what will probably happen is that person will sign on to the United Nations Small Arms Treaty. Dudley Brown is president of the National Association of Gun Rights. He has a petition he'd like you to sign. He joins us now. Dudley, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, John, thanks for having me.
What does the petition say, and to whom will it be sent?
Well, if you track this issue at all, I think you have really the United Nations Arms Trade Treaty has to go through an administration and a U.S. Senate. There's really no choice. They really have to go through both. And so having the United States Senate oppose this, this move, all these moves by the United Nations is vital. And that's really the only pressure point gun owners have in America to apply. I'd love to say that there were a great number of other areas, but it all comes down to the United States Senate, which is why U.S. Senate races are so critical in the fight to save the Second Amendment.
Yeah, and I see that Rand Paul has been promoting the petition, and I got an email saying please sign the petition. So he's behind it. He's one senator have on your side.
Well, Senator Rand Paul's been a very active member of the National Association for Gun Rights even before he was a United States senator. He's been a supporter of ours and still kind of remains our celebrity member in the U.S. Senate. But Senator Mike Lee is certainly an activist. So is Senator Eric Schmidt. We've had Senator Kennedy does a lot of work for us. There are a lot of solid conservatives, not as many as you'd think. And frankly, they understand the problems we enter, not just on Second Amendment issues, but of course, sovereignty issues. If you're ceding sovereignty on this issue on a constitutional right, well, what's stopping you from ceding sovereignty on almost anything that's not directly enumerated in the Bill of Rights?
Yeah. Well, the United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research sounds like something no American should want to be part of. What is that?
Well, here's the funny part about all this, and it's, I have to laugh because that's the only way to stay sane, is the United Nations always talks about this arms trade treaty since the whole idea came about back under Barack Obama and with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State supporting it, as they couch it in these terms that they want to stop large nations from selling tanks to other all kinds of nations around the world. They want to curtail the sale of arms. And most, I think, Americans are at least willing to entertain some of that concept, but the devil's, of course, in the details. They're not really aiming at that. What they're really aiming for, and why they put so much pressure on the United States to be involved in this, is they want to look at ways to stop the private ownership of firearms. You don't have to be a member of the John Birch Society and believe in every conspiracy to believe that's true. I don't believe in many conspiracies, to be honest. But this is one that's out front. It's very much in the open. They've said that they want ways to curtail the trade of small arms. And when they say small arms, they mean the firearms that everyday Americans use to hunt, use to target shoot, use to just have fun with, use for self-defense. They don't believe that's legitimate. And they know that to get other countries to agree to this arms trade treaty and to, quotes, have it have effect, they need the United States. And so we've been the major thorn in their side. I believe this year will be a pivotal year for them. And it'll come down to August in Geneva. The 10th Conference of State Parties is held in Geneva every year. I'm going this year. We had a representative last year who stood up and made some great remarks. You can see it on our YouTube channel. But this year, I believe I'm going to go, and I'm going to basically make the same arguments, but then I'm going to make them, a lot of them, in private with members of other nations, because I think the war, the aggressive nature of Vladimir Putin and the way he rolled troops into the Ukraine, regardless of what you think about funding that war, the fact is everyone saw it coming. And the Ukrainians really couldn't do much because they disarmed their citizens.
Yeah.
It would have been very, very difficult for the Russians to make any headway had the citizens been armed.
Yeah, well, think about how what would the difference be in Ukraine, or would it have been, if the same percentage of Ukrainians owned guns as Americans?
I got it.
The Russians might be a little. Go ahead.
When that first happened, I had a good friend, a member of Congress, who's well known in the Second Amendment space, and called me up and asked me if he thought there was any way we could gather privately owned firearms. This is just hours after the invasion. How do we get privately owned firearms to the Ukraine in private citizens' hands? And we tried. We actually went to look at how to do it and realized, of course, there's no way to do that with the Pentagon involved and the State Department. But we were going to call for Americans to do just like we did during World War II with the Lend-Lease program, say, volunteer your firearms and donate them to Ukrainian people to repel the Russian invaders.
Yeah. Well, Israel...
it would have been a punch in the nose.
Oh, yeah.
That's for sure.
Well, I remember on the October 7th attacks, I think I saw that only 2% of Israelis own guns. And you think Hamas didn't know that?
Hamas knew it, and I do know that the government relaxed some of the restrictions.
Yeah, after the attack.
After the attack. And of course, it's the same lesson. If those Israeli citizens had more personal firearms for self-defense, not the firearms that they normally keep after they've served in the military, but you know, rifles privately owned, it could make a difference. We know it would have made a difference. We know it made a difference in the Warsaw Ghetto.
Yep.
In Poland, mm-hmm. During World War II, mm-hmm. after the Germans had invaded Poland in September of 1939, and created this ghetto in Warsaw, and we know that just a small group of completely untrained and not even firearms aficionados, just everyday artists and doctors, who said, let's get a hold of just a few firearms and let's start knocking off the German soldiers who were occupying the city and keeping them at bay. And they started with one and got another and got another. And pretty soon they were holding off an entire battalion of German soldiers.
Yeah, there was. I saw a movie.
20 some people.
I saw a movie a couple of years ago, and it didn't get much attention. But it should have been a movie that all gun rights people should have wanted to see. I can't think of the name of it now. It was something about a zoo, and it may have been Warsaw, but it was a true story. And it was about what happened when the Germans were trying to do what the Germans did back then, and people in one town, it might have been Warsaw. It showed how they used their guns, and the Germans, it changes everything for the attacker when he's not sure if when he opens the door he's going to get shot in the face. They tend to, I don't know, be a little bit less aggressive maybe.
Yeah, a good punch in the nose.
Yeah.
One particular movie that I really enjoy was about a little more than 20 years ago. It was called Uprising. It had David Schwimmer from Friends. And John Voight and Donald Sutherland, all about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Yeah. And there have been quite a few films about it that I think illustrate the point. To come back to the United Nations.
Yeah, well, I'm going to ask you real quick, though, and we're talking to Dudley Moore, he's president of the National Association of Gun Rights. Before I forget, because you were talking about how the United Nations, the disarmament research, United Nations Institute for Disarmament Research, and how they really need the United States, you know, to get to their objectives. How much do the people in the United States who love gun control need the United Nations? And how much will they be pushing for this? Because they know that for the same reasons that the United Nations wants it, they think it's going to help them disarm people. Are there Americans that are going to be pushing for it?
Well, there always have been. Some of it is, again, under the guise of stopping warships being sold. But that dog doesn't really hunt.
Mm-hmm.
When it came down to it, Hillary Clinton was pushing for a simple reason. She was trying to curtail American Second Amendment rights. And, you know, that is a difficult thing in America because, frankly, we have a very large group of people who are very noisy, and we are willing to fight it out in all political circles. Now, John, I'm going to tell you that the most dangerous time is when Republicans are in charge, because they, as the saying goes, it took Nixon to go to China. Sometimes Republicans are the biggest danger. It's why I was not a fan of Mitt Romney when he was the nominee for Republicans to run for the presidency in 2012. And I'm not very much a fan of Donald Trump's, to be honest. He's been very poor on the gun issue. But we give him credit. He unsigned us as much as you can unsign us from it. But we still funded the United Nations. That's the other thing that the United Nations is very excited about getting the United States on board, is because it brings funding. And even during the Trump administration, we were still paying for the arms trade treaty through the United Nations. And we think that's outrageous. American taxpayers, especially when they're not even signers on the arms trade treaty, should not be paying for this.
Now, that's what I'd like to see, is kick the United Nations out and United States just leave the United Nations. But that's, I've been on that page for a long time. I see that 141 countries have either ratified or signed on to this treaty. I guess that's not surprising. But what may be a more important number is the number of countries that haven't signed it yet or say they'll never sign it. Who's out there not signing it?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of them who haven't got it through their procedure. The big one, I mean, obviously the United States.
Yeah.
Some of those that actually don't sign but started administering it, like South Africa, have had the biggest effect. Many people, any people who are listening are big gun people and have been for a while. You'll know that ammunition got extremely expensive really about 20 years ago, 18 years ago. And a lot of that was that South Africa had agreed to the arms trade treaty principles and was starting to actually use them. And of course, this was under the ANC and you know, essentially a far left regime.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the supplier of about 8% of the surplus 30 caliber ammunition in the world. Well, if you all of a sudden 8% of the market's gone, guess what the price does?
Yeah.
Skyrockets. It doesn't skyrocket 8%. A lot more than that. And that's when you really saw the massive increase in ammunition prices, and then it kept cascading into other areas. And then, of course, there were a lot of other things that contributed to that. But to go back to the treaty itself, the simple fact is, right now, the biggest one that's pushing for the arms trade treaty is China. Communist China.
They're a big fan of it, huh?
Yeah, and they love it. And that should send chills down your spine.
It'll tell you all you need to know.
Tells you all you need to know. In fact, they've really been working on over the last year on ammunition controls. And they want to regulate ammunition and have every UN signatory developing a new framework to regulate ammunition on a global scale. They figure, well, if you can't get ammunition, you have really, you know, the arms are pretty worthless.
Yeah.
And that is a dangerous and let's call it very, very slippery slope, because there are some components of ammunition that are extremely difficult to produce. I mean, people are now printing firearms, and that genie is out of the bottle. But primers are a very difficult thing to manufacture. There are only a few places in the world that actually produce primers, and the major components of a primer that's very difficult is cellulose. And cellulose is also the main major component of gunpowder, and so smokeless gunpowder. Well, the combination is very difficult, and the Chinese desperately want to have all kinds of tagants and tracking methods on ammunition so they can know where it goes. And anytime somebody says we want to know how a gun's made and track it, or how ammunition's made and track it, you should be worried.
Well,
it means they want to control it.
Hey, Dudley, I'm out of time. Real quick, tell me where people can sign the petition.
You can go to gunrights.org and click on any number of the links there. It's a great place to get involved in the fight, not only in Congress on this issue, but on a great number of issues all around the country in every state legislature, including Pennsylvania, where we're pushing for constitutional carry. So.
Okay. Dudley Brown, president of the National Association of Gun Rights. Thanks for coming on the show. Hope to talk again.
Thank you, John.
Okay. And that's Dudley Brown. I'll be right back. Well, I didn't have time to go into this, but this is redstate.com, and the headline is New York City man convicted over gunsmithing hobby after judge says Second Amendment doesn't exist in this courtroom. This guy was making guns. He decided that it was a nice hobby to be a gunsmith. He made a bunch of guns. Somehow the NYPD or the New York State Police or somebody found out what he was doing. He was raided, SWAT team, the whole thing. He went to trial, was convicted. He's on Rikers Island right now. And the judge she's a woman, Abina Darke, took over the case, and this is a quote from her, according to the defense attorney. Do not bring the Second Amendment into this courtroom. It doesn't exist here. So you can't argue Second Amendment. This is New York. That's what she said. This is a judge. And what that tells me is that she's a strong candidate to be nominated to the Supreme Court by some Democrat. First of all, it's New York. She's an idiot, and she's ridiculously liberal and clueless. So She's on the fast track to the Supreme Court. Do not bring the Second Amendment into this courtroom. It doesn't exist here. You can't argue Second Amendment. This is New York. You know what? She's right. It is New York, and she can have it. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.